Hello and welcome. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar today, and this is Your Call. So, how do you teach a boy to become a man? And how do you teach that boy to know himself so well that it doesn't matter what society thinks about him or how society portrays him? And for so many inner-city young black boys, why does it seem that it just isn't hip to be square? What is that about? Black men are asking these questions and answering them on a project called Question Bridge. It's a transmedia project, and it seeks to facilitate a dialogue between black men across the country. They offer their views, and participants are given an opportunity to take their shot at redefining black men and their identity in America. The video installation website and the app create a connection and an understanding among black men, and it offers a diversity of thought in the black male population, and it's a pretty rare thing to be seen in American media. So that's our conversation today on Your Call. Artists Chris Johnson, Hank Willis Thomas, and Kamal Sinclair all collaborated to record over 1,600 question and answer videos. They went to over 160 men in 9 different cities across the country. And the resultant project was called Question Bridge, Black Males. It's now been exhibited at nearly 40 institutions around the world. So, what can we learn from the questions that these men are asking and from their conversations about the answers? We're talking today with two of the collaborators on Question Bridge. The original idea guy is here. Chris Johnson is a photographer, and he is the creator of the Question Bridge project. He is a professor and chair of the photography program at the California College of the Arts, along with a lot of other bona fides. Chris Johnson, remarkable accomplishments, and congratulations on the Question Bridge project. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
Also joining us by phone is Kamal Sinclair. Kamal is director of the Sundance Institute's New Frontier Labs program. That program supports artists working at the convergence of film, art, media, and technology. And she's also served as an artist and producer on Question Bridge. Thank you so much, Kamal, for joining us.
So happy to be here. Thank you.
What a remarkable project, actually. It's kind of one of those things where to really fully grasp the impact, you kind of have to see it. And it's easy enough to do. You just hit play and you get a recording of all of these people who are really exploring very in-depth things. And it kind of makes you wonder, why haven't people explored this before? So, Chris, let's start with you. What was the genesis? Why take this approach to such a complex question about black males in America?
Well, the origins of the Question Bridge Project goes back to, believe it or not, Bed-Stuy.
In New York,
where I grew up in the 60s at a time when, because of restrictive housing laws, African-Americans of all classes had to live together in the same neighborhood. And when I grew up, I finally saw what happened when those laws were passed. African-Americans who had the means to leave left. And so that division between the black communities was something that was an early experience in my life. So many, many years later, in 1996, I was asked to create a project to coincide with the Republican convention happening in San Diego. And I had to think of some way to try to create a healing dialogue between African-Americans who live very different lifestyles. And I knew that bringing them together in one place wouldn't allow them to speak freely. So I thought, well, maybe if I videotaped them simply asking deeply felt questions of each other, that would make them feel safe, and they would ask really honest questions. And I could take those questions in video form to people who live a very different lifestyle, and maybe people in their own homes, you know, in a safe setting would provide answers to those questions, and I could then edit it together into like a fake conversation. And that original project, Question Bridge Black Community, worked really well. And so 10, 12 years later, Hank Willis Thomas, who was a graduate student of mine at California College of the Arts, saw a version of that project that I sent to his mother, Deb Willis, a great scholar and photographer. And he called me and said, why don't we do another version of this that, that deals with the differences that black men feel from each other? And we used the exact same format. So we traveled, as you said, to 11 different cities around the country over 4 years, and simply gave black men an opportunity to ask a question into the camera that they felt of a black man that they felt very different from. And we gathered many, many answers and put it together to create this project, Question Bridge Black Males.
Interesting that you used the format, the Q&A format. It wasn't just statements. They were literally posing questions. Why? Why did that happen?
Well, I had done a project in the early 90s together with Suzanne Lacey, a great performance artist. She came to my school as a dean, and we did a project called The Roof is on Fire that was based on the process of listening. So you can imagine kids, inner city kids, teenage kids in cars on a rooftop in downtown Oakland, and they had badges around their necks that said, shut up and listen. Mm. So in that setting, they asked and answered and just spoke as if they were by themselves while the audience of mainly white people from the hills eavesdropped on them and listened. So that was a very powerful process. And I could see that the people who were listening were being very generous in a kind of passive way. So when I was asked a few years later to create another project, I thought, well, what's a more active way for people to be generous? And asking a question, I think, is an active form of generosity. And I know that people who live within the same demographic but have differences between them have critical questions that they would like to get answers to. Mm-hmm. And when you ask someone a question, as you know really well, you're setting yourself up to listen. And so I thought, well, maybe this form of providing a safe space for people to pose deeply held questions and then getting answers would work. And so that's how the Question Bridge Project came to be.
Kamau, you're a female involved in a project that is, by its definition, all about men. How did that come to be?
I know. Well, I'm honored to be part of this incredible group between Hales Thomas, obviously, Chris and K. Ross Smith, who was their black man that was part of the Core Four artist team. And when I came to the project, I came years later after they had already been able to record 1,000 question and answer exchanges. And I was working in Atlanta with the Woodruff Arts Center, working on a lot of kind of diversity and work and just work with the National Black Arts Festival. And so when Hank said, hey, we want to come to Atlanta and record some question and answers with black men, I was in a position to be able to provide space and to invite men from the community to come and be recorded. And that night, after they had finished recording, we ended up sitting up almost all night long. And they were showing me clip after clip after clip of these question and answer exchanges that they had captured. And they were, and you know, Hank and Chris were particularly asking, so what do you think would be the most ideal format to share this with the world? Is it, you know, installation? Is it a documentary film? And I had been looking into research on how to kind of when you think about the context, this is at the dawn of social media and at the dawn of YouTube. This is like 2009 when, you know, people were in that kind of 2-year honeymoon with democratized media production that they could do on their phones and so forth. And I had been looking deeply for traditional arts institutions. How do we kind of make porous the brick and mortar of a theater or a museum or a symphony, so that this kind of digital cultural revolution that was happening can also kind of come and go and influence the culture that's happening in the brick and mortar spaces. And so I basically stumbled upon some of the early thinking in interactive documentary and transmedia nonlinear storytelling. And when I looked at all of these incredible voices that they had recorded, and knowing what their mission was in trying to, you know, which was a very personal mission from mm-hmm. what Chris and Hank and Bayate had shared with me as black men wanting to explore and break kind of the monolithic containers that media had kind of stereotyped black men into over, you know, 100 years of film and you know, print and so forth. And so when I looked at, heard all these voices, I was waiting and I was listening for redundancy. I was listening for where it got boring, or I was listening for when yet another video was not adding to the conversation, and I could not find it. Mm. I was struck by the incredible diversity of thought and how they had achieved in this, you know, an incredible breaking of the container of what, you know, blackness and maleness was. And I said, you know, you should consider putting this on the internet so that it doesn't have to be restrained by the editing requirements of an installation or documentary, where we would, you know, you would be then curating out voices that are critical to understanding the diversity and the true complexity of this identity group. And so I was brought in, you know, just to support as a grant writer and as a, you know, transmedia consultant. And then, you know, the relationship grew where I was able to participate as a full artist. But I must say, we were really clear about making sure that me as a woman, I'm black, but as a woman, that I didn't come into the spaces where they were recording, so that I didn't change the dynamic of the conversation of black men speaking with black men. And that was really, I think, an important aspect of this, of not intruding on that safe space for black men to speak to black men.
You know, I wondered about that. Yeah, I was talking to Chris before we started the show, and I was telling him that my dad was a barber. And there was this space, there was something sacred about the barber shop, and there are five all girls in my family, so we never really knew what went on in there. And you know, and Daddy guarded it carefully, because it really was, there was something sacred about that time when, you know, men got to just talk amongst themselves. And so to some extent, I think your respect for that space probably was part of why it turned out to be so poignant. But I also thought it was interesting, based on the way Chris described it, the questions were posed and then the answers were given, but it was edited together. Given that these weren't actual conversations, it's really striking when you actually watch the video that the dialogue sounds seamless and very, very real. I thought that was amazing, Kamal.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I have to say that when you think about it, and Chris, you say this so articulately and beautifully, you know, there, I think any identity group, especially marginalized identity groups, always have a conversation going, whether it be verbal or implicit, that is a shared experience, but also one that needs a space to be articulated, because there are nuances in the diversity of that experience that you could see it happening, you know, in the exchanges that you know, the answers to a single question, you might have 10, 20, you know, 25, that each kind of bring a slightly different nuanced piece of the puzzle. And even if they're in complete juxtaposition of each other, it enriches and deepens, you know, our understanding of this experience of being black in America. And you know, I believe from the people that we've spoken to over the years, the experience of being black and male in America. And one, I think it helps to validate what you're feeling. It helps to deepen, you know, as you're hearing other people's experiences, it helps to also expand and enrich, you know, the context of what that means.
Let's give folks an idea of exactly what we're talking about here. This is a clip from Question Bridge, Black Males. And this particular clip deals with the influence of fathers on the lives of young black boys.
Do you think your life is different because your father was not in your life? And do you blame your mom because she didn't want that part of your life?
No. I don't blame my mother either, because if my father was in my life, I'd probably be on the streets, on the corner, doing things I'm not supposed to do, to where my mother is my father figure and my mother at the same time, because she raised me all my life without my father.
as a young adult, I found myself gathered with other black men who didn't have their fathers in present, physically or emotionally or otherwise. And what we sort of did is fathered each other, meaning we challenged each other in the ways that we were out of line, whether it was educationally, socially, with women, or personally. And we challenged ourselves to be better. Now, as adults, I think it's incumbent upon us, and I do this myself, is to actually pull young black men, young black kids aside and talk to them and provide guidance.
That is a clip from Question Bridge, Black Males. It's a transmedia project that's facilitating dialogue between black men across the country. And Chris, are any of these questions scripted or are they scripted?
Yeah, I think that's a really logical question, because when you see the project, as Kamal said, it's really hard not to be impressed by the depth and the insight and the thoughtfulness and intelligence and the range of what the men say. And so it's fair to ask, where does that come from?
Yes.
And so when you think, everyone, all of our listeners have had life-changing conversations. So what did it take for a life-changing, powerful, effective conversation to happen? Well, the first thing it takes is humanity, which we all share. Okay, so the depth of humanity is there on both sides. And then it takes a setting that builds trust, that allows us to speak freely with each other. So you talked earlier about the barbershop creating a culture, you know, that allowed men to share and trust each other. So basically what the Question Bridge format does is it taps, first of all, it makes the assumption that all of us are human beings that have this great depth. And one of the things that Kamal was referencing was a thought that I had, that any marginalized person who walks down the street, like, for example, think of a young man, you know, with his pants slung low. Okay. So he knows that without it being open, people are asking him the question, why do you dress like that? You know, so he's having an internal conversation. He's like walking under a cloud of these questions, and he's rehearsing answers to those questions. So that's why when you get him in a setting where he's open and feels trusting, he will speak directly to questions that he knows are relevant to his life and are elements of his identity. So all this project does is structure those elements, humanity, setting, and trust, to allow for a free flow of really powerful content, which our culture desperately needs, particularly as it relates to the identities of black males who are likely to be seen as, you know, sullen and unimportant.
Did you find that this turned out to be mostly intergenerational, young folks asking questions of their elders and older folks asking young folks, what are y'all doing? Or did it turn out to be intergenerational?
Well, I mean, intergeneration is one dimension of it. But one of the things that that Hank brought to the project was the notion that every black man feels that he has questions of men who are different from himself. So we allowed the men to define how they see themselves as being different and what questions they have across those differences. So that meant that generation, class, education, we had men who asked questions of what it was like being homosexual, incarcerated black men. Like, one of the most powerful questions that came from the project was, do you feel free? What does it feel like to be a black man? Do you really feel free? So I got access to incarcerated men at CJ5 here in San Bruno, and was able to present that question to an incarcerated man who gave a really passionate answer about the ways that people are not free in everyday life. So, you know, the questions really span the range of black male consciousness.
And when you say Hank, you're referring to Hank Willis Thomas. Who, along with you and Kamal Sinclair, collaborated to record these. How did you select folks of the 1,600 videos, 160 men? How did, you know, I would think that there would be a difference between folks who got drafted to do this and folks who volunteered. So how did you choose?
Well, Kamal is laughing. Hey, Kamal.
I'm laughing because, just one funny story is we were in Chicago. We had 2 days of, we had a venue over 2 days to record And we were driving to the place we were staying, and Chris saw a brother on the street, jumped out the car at the stoplight, and approached the brother and say, "Hey, we're gonna be recording tomorrow. Would you come down and ask some questions and answer some questions?" And the brother showed up.
Absolutely,
one of the most phenomenal. I mean, insights that he brought were just floored all of us. So it was in terms of method. And the other one, the first gentleman that they approached in the project was just somebody Chris was sitting next to on the plane to the first venue and said, "Hey, we're going to be," he was a security guard. He said, "Hey, we're going to be, recording tomorrow. Do you want to come by?" So there was that aspect. There was posting on Facebook, "Hey, Christian Bridge in town." There was a lot of, sending out emails to all of our friends in the city. "Hey, can you," but I think the thing that's really important about why we also put it on the internet and not, I mean, the thousand question answer exchanges that were captured, in this kind of, very one-on-one in real life, in kind of almost like sacred spaces that Chris and Hank and Bayate created, were powerful, and they kind of set the tone of the respect that and the earnestness with which the project was, and everybody that picked up on that tone came into the project with that same respect and earnestness. But then putting it on the internet was also an opportunity to make sure that our own blind spots or our own limitations in our network of connections didn't limit, this kind of the robustness and the diversity of thought. And yes, there were still challenges with who's wired and who's not wired in a community to participate.
Yes.
So we also tried to work with community organizations. We had street teams in New York and in Los Angeles, and we worked within school systems. So we tried as much as possible to create entry points for both, people that are, kind of net and mobile app savvy, and those that may have never touched, a mobile app in their life.
But, I think it's worth saying, and this is one of the remarkable things in what essentially was a creative experiment, that over the 4 years that Hank and I and Bayate traveled around the country, not one black man said no. There was one man who said, "I'm too shy," which is understandable on a human level. But of the thousands of men that we approached, as Kamal said, I would stop on the street and get people. They all had a reason to ask a deep question, and or they provided really profound answers to the questions that were presented to them. So I think that says a lot about the need all human beings have to be heard and to express themselves. And I think that's one of the things that's made this project so successful and enduring.
You mentioned the name Bayate. He couldn't be with us today, but we want to give him his props. Bayate Ross Smith, also one of the originators of the project. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Kamal Sinclair and Chris Johnson, creators of Question Bridge, Black Males. It's a multimedia, transmedia project that facilitates a dialogue between black men across the country. And it's an attempt to help redefine what black male identity means in America. We're going to take a break here shortly, and when we come back, we're going to hear another clip from the project and invite your questions. So stay with us. Welcome back. We're talking today about Question Bridge, Black Males, a platform that's meant to help explore and redefine black male identity. We hope you'll be around tomorrow on your call. We're going to be talking sports stadiums. What do those projects mean for the communities in which they're built? Very often they're sold as being a real boon to the local economy, creating lots of jobs. Hundreds of millions of often taxpayer dollars get spent on those projects. But research is showing that in the long run, sometimes those turn out to be very bad deals for the cities in which they're located. So why do they continue to be subsidized? So hope you'll join us for the next Your Call. That's tomorrow. Again, today we are talking Question Bridge. It's a fascinating project that uses transmedia to open a dialogue between and among African-American men. And you can go to questionbridge.com to actually take a look at this project. And Chris Johnson and Kamal Sinclair are with me today. And we invite your input, 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. If you've already experienced Question Bridge, if you've seen it exhibited, did you see yourself reflected in the more than 150 men who offered questions and answers? The questions and answers were so wide-ranging, it's hard to imagine that it didn't strike a chord somehow. But I also thought it was interesting that some of the questions are pretty esoteric. Like, when do you become a man? One man says, when you become financially stable, when you're able to take care of yourself, and when you buy your mama a house. You know, that is, and I mean, that's real. I get that, right? But imagine what a different range of answers there would be to that very same question. So, Chris, there were clearly so many different ways to answer. What did you find about the definition that black men have of themselves?
Well, first of all, I have to say that that question came from the 9-year-old son of Malik Yoba. Mm. So that gives you a sense of how, again, in the proper setting, what for you is a heartfelt question will come to the surface. Mm-hmm. So that was a really refreshing and beautiful thing to say, to hear. So your question was?
How did you, the wide-ranging perception of just what it is to have black male identity in America?
Well, it's not surprising that for black men, the issue of how their identities are formed is an issue, mm-hmm. is a concern. So that was one of the sort of abiding themes. Like one of the questions was, if I prefer Picasso to Romare Bearden, can I still be black? Mm-hmm. Or why am I considered to be a traitor to my race if I date outside of my race? So there were a lot of questions that showed sort of the heartfelt way that black men are ambiguous, mm. you know, can be ambiguous about the nature of their role in society. And you can imagine that for any thoughtful question, there were five answers that sometimes contradicted each other. Mm-hmm. So the way that the project is edited tries to make it clear that there's no fixed way that you can stereotype what a black man is. That's why redefinition of black male identity is such a key part of one of our themes. Black men are given this platform to represent themselves and the diversity of their views and values.
Come on, we're there. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I was going to say there's also some scientific foundation to this. So we did a lot of look into stereotype threat, inferiority and superiority complexes, implicit bias. And we worked closely with the Campaign for Black Male Achievement, which was a key resource and supporter financially and in terms of helping us gain access to what the approaches to education and kind of the challenges with the achievement gap and discipline gap and all of those things that were happening and are happening, as well as mass incarceration. I mean, this is the same group that funded Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow. And so we were part of a very rich community of people that were looking deeply at this from a lot of different lenses. And one of the things that was really surprising was something that really we found to be aligned with what we were seeing from an artistic lens that also matched up with a scientific lens was things like stereotype threat and how when you only see one version of yourself represented, especially in media, it does impact the performance of identity. And it particularly, you know, one of the examples would be, when African Americans taking the GRE graduate level entrance exam for mm-hmm. university, they were half of them were told put your name only at the top of the test, and others were told to put their name and their race at the top of the test, and there was a significant differential in performance. The people that put their race at the top of the test performed more poorly than just put their name. So, part of the power of this project is trying to push back on those very dangerous, narrow, monolithic, and often agendized images and representations of blackness and maleness in our media that are quite literally impacting our daily lives. It also impacts the ways in which, you're seen through the lens of, the narratives of, like, Birth of a Nation, those kinds of things that put black men in the position of, what is to be feared. And that it impacts all kinds of aspects of mobility and achievement, and also in terms of over-policing and over-disciplining in schools. So, you know, unleashing, creating a platform that really complicates all of those really dangerous narratives is critical, I think, to the ways in which we think about representation going forward, so that we can shed ourselves from those kinds of stereotype threat dynamics.
But, you know, I just want to add one thing. I mean, the points that Kamala's making is clearly true. But one of the things that's remarkable about this project is that as an art project, the way that we make those arguments is not in pedantic scientific terms. It's purely human terms. I mean, a man will look into the lens, and the question that he's carrying in his heart is, what makes you better than me just because you speak and talk differently? Mm. That's a raw question that's presented to the black male audience. So you present that question to a range of different men, and they answer back with the pushback that Kamala is talking about, but in purely human terms. They'll say, well, nothing makes me better. Or, you know, I do feel challenged when I go from one place to another. This doctor talked about how going from his life to Harvard and how he felt challenged. I mean, hearing that expressed in purely human terms, mm-hmm. you know, without sociological jargon, is what makes it so accessible to everyday human beings, because basically the audience for this project are black men, that's for sure, but also non-black men who are looking for insights into the way black men think and feel. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the conclusions that Kamala's talking about fall naturally from the way people express themselves when they're given an opportunity to address these really deeply troubling questions.
Mm-hmm. Well, to the extent... And also, I'm sorry. Sure, go ahead, Kamala.
Oh, I was going to say, just to be vulnerable, like, going deeply into all of this, you know, the project implicit, you know, that happened between three universities shows that less than 20% of Americans can look at black faces and not associate negative wording, which is so deep in the subconscious, you know, the subconscious bias that we hold from a lot of priming over hundreds of years here. And so that means that black people ourselves are not immune from these kind of priming, this kind of representation priming that we've had to endure. And so I myself, when I was working on, we were working on the project, I made it a practice to check my own bias around black men, like when I'm getting on the subway or walking down the street. You know, there's this like, you know, oh, I gotta make sure that, especially for a woman who used to, you know, trying to navigate the world of men in general, you know, there's this guard that you put on around any man. But we also have a particular bias, quite frankly, in America around black men. So I checked that. I made it a practice to check my own bias. And I remember dropping my guard and looking brothers in the face and saying hello in a way that was not, that guard went away. And it was just like, oh man, I can't tell you these human experiences that I had of being able to just, oh, you're not scared of me? Like, it was just this notion, this thing of, oh, you're not scared of me? And it was just like, thank God she's not scared of me. You know what I mean? Like, it was really powerful not being a black male and having to face that.
I just want to add one other thing, because what Kamal really beautifully expressed is exactly the intention of what Question Bridge Black Males hopes to do. Mm-hmm. Because we assume that any viewer coming into our installations has a lot of those implicit biases. I mean, black, male, whatever. So our hope is that what this project will do is take you wherever you're starting and project you into a dim room where 160 black men are being as vulnerable and as insightful and as thoughtful as they can be. And you get to be a privileged witness to this private conversation, like an eavesdropper into the barbershop, for mm-hmm, example. Mm-hmm. And you know that that's going to be a transformative experience, because it's really hard to stigmatize somebody who you know, even to a small degree. Mm-hmm. So it's ambitious, I know, but what we intend with this project to do is radically change the way people perceive black male identity. And I think it does that by creating a kind of familiarity that is really hard to generate any other way.
Well, speaking of this immersive experience, Black Males, Question Bridge Black Males opens tonight at the Mary Porter Cezanne Gallery on the UC Santa Cruz campus, and it runs through April the 6th. It's already appeared at the Oakland Museum.
And it's there at the Oakland Museum permanently.
Mm. And it's immersive. It really is experiential in so many ways. 866-798-8255. If you have questions for Chris Johnson and Kamal Sinclair about Question Bridge, let's go to the phones. Hi, Joshua in Oakland. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. Thank you for doing this program and this artist. Really great. I'm just wondering, how are you planning to integrate it into the schools? I teach in Oakland, work in Oakland, teach teachers in Oakland, and I'm wondering if you have a way to force it onto the students in some way so they have to reckon with it.
Force it onto the students. Well, you know, I guess there's reason to talk about the different kinds of pedagogy that are available. There certainly is explicit pedagogy, you know, where the Question Bridge blackmails exists largely through the creative efforts of Kamal Sinclair and other people, Joey DeGruy, and they put together a curriculum that's available through the website for free. Through to educators. If you go to the questionbridge.com website, you'll see very prominently on the homepage an educate button that takes you to modules that we've created, and there's much more to be said about this. A project that I'm working on together with the Harvey Gantt Center in North Carolina. I'm going in April to a teachers' institute that will deliver exposure to the Question Bridge curricular tools to teachers, and the idea is for the school system as a whole to recognize the value of integrating this into their curricula broadly, not just to African American achievement gap classes, but to see the value of it in history and English and sociology at all levels. So, but any enterprising teacher who wants to go and experience it, you know, Kamal and her team put together lesson plans and teacher guides and bibliographies, and I've recently modified it and added a couple of modules. So those tools are available for any teacher who wants to go just by going to questionbridge.com.
You know, let's listen to another clip from Question Bridge. This one has to do with African-American males and their health. Mental health, physical health, and how they look at that. Let's listen to that clip again from Question Bridge.
So, question, why is it so difficult for black men to go to the doctor on a regular basis to check our physical health or our mental health?
My brother, I told him 3 years before he had prostate cancer, when was the last time he had his prostate checked? He said, oh, I don't get that done. I said, when's the last time you've been to the doctor? He said, oh, about 4 years ago. I said, man, you need to go. I told him, I said, I get mine checked all the time. And I said, colonoscopy. And I told him all these things. 3 years later, he had advanced stage of prostate cancer, metastasized, and he died. But I sometimes get angry at him because when I told him what to do, he refused to do it. And to this day, to think about it, it hurts. Because he could have done something. He could still be here. He could still be with me. But what did he do? He wouldn't listen. I should have made him go. And see, that's one thing about black men. We think we're so strong, we think we're so great, and we don't need anybody. We're okay, and there's nothing wrong. And that's not true. Your mental health, too. I mean, some black men don't even know that they have depression that can lead into suicide. And what do? They don't do anything about it. And so I can't understand why they don't do it.
That is a clip from Question Bridge. That's the kind of experiential thing that we're talking about here, that people get real. And
absolutely.
Yeah. So, Chris, I mean, it's kind of hard to even recover listening to what that, what the opportunity for this man to say this out loud meant to him. Do you remember this interview and what it meant to you?
Yeah, I do. Again, you know, when you recognize that you've got a forum that allows for a man to express obviously a deeply held feeling. You privilege that. You feel kind of blessed. Mm-hmm. I mean, so I'm behind the camera. We set him up. We presented him with a videotape of that question that came from Malik Yoba. And then he went with it where his heart took him. And so as editors and directors, you know, I was just really aware of when I should stop, and I just kept rolling. Mm-hmm. And he continued to express himself, and it got deeper and deeper and deeper until, you know, the result is what you heard.
And Kamal, you made a point of saying that you stayed out of the mix. And my guess is that it was in hopes that a man who might not ordinarily feel comfortable being this raw and this vulnerable would, in fact, be able to open up in this way. Yes?
Yeah. I mean, I will admit that I was in one session one time in New York City, and it was, everybody agreed that the tone and everything changed, that the few men that I was in the room when they interviewed, mm-hmm. that they were performing, and there was a certain kind of performance for a woman that was in the room that changed from what Hank and Bayate and Chris had experienced other. So I'm kind of, this is a dialogue that we had, and that's when we were like, oh yeah, it's absolutely true that if I'm in the room, it changes the dynamic. For whatever reason, you know, whether it be gendered, you know, norms or issues, or just straight up, you know, trying to look good in front of a woman or something like that. Mm-hmm. But it definitely changed the dynamic. And so I never walked into one of the interviews again.
It was really moving to hear him open up that way. And, you know, I've been a TV reporter for the better part of my career, and I found that whenever there's a camera present, people just can't, you know, they find it difficult to open up. So how did you make him forget that that was there and just get real?
Yeah, I mean, there's an element of this that that feels like providence, frankly. Mm-hmm. Like we were just blessed to have the right project at the right time with the right collection of men. But then after 4 years of doing this, you realize that there's something deeper than that, that this project by its very nature is fulfilling a human need. It just takes the right setting. People ask all the time, did you prompt them? Sometimes we would say, I would say, what did you mean by that? Or could you express that a different way? I mean, that happened very rarely. But mostly what you're seeing is spontaneous expression of deeply felt content that people needed to share, both questions and answers.
They were probably, in some cases, thinking, thank you, God, for this opportunity. Thank God somebody asked, yes?
I think so.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there was a moment outside of a gallery where we had exhibited in South L.A., and I just showed up at the gallery late, and I was just approaching the front door, and there was about three brothers standing out in front with the mobile app open on their phone, and they had just come out of the exhibition. And I overheard them saying, this is for us, y'all. Can you believe this is for us? Like, it was just this moment for me of hearing something that Chris had talked about before, like these kind of moments where people are like, oh, you're asking me my opinion? Like, an opinion that has not, for some folks, has never been asked in this kind of public way and with this kind of respect. So I do think that there's an element of the tone that Chris and Hank and Bayate have set that created that sense of true respect and trust.
If you just join us, we are with Kamal Sinclair, director of the Sundance Institute's New Frontier Labs program. She's also served as an artist and producer on Question Bridge, Black Males, the project that we're talking about today. And we're joined in studio by Chris Johnson. He's a photographer, but also creator of the Question Bridge project. He's a professor and chair of the photography program at the California College of the Arts. 866-798-8255 is the number to call if you have questions for them about the project. We heard from Nancy in Berkeley, and she says she has a mixed-race grandson who looks white but has African-American heritage on his mom's side. So how can he navigate that identity? Chris, any thoughts? And does this project address that kind of racial identity question?
Absolutely. It definitely does. You know, but I think Kamal might have more insight into this in a certain way than I do.
Go ahead, Kamal. Well, My mother is white, my father is black, and one of the things that I think I was drawn to about this project, and some of the things that we put into the website where you could create words that define yourself in your own terms for each profile, was that, you know, growing up in the 70s and 80s, it was black or white. You know, there wasn't even a, now there's a other or interracial, but there wasn't even that when I was really much younger. And although I think like most mixed people in this country identify strongly as black, if you're black, you know, kind of the whole one drop rule and all of those things that kind of have a context in this country, you know, there is a spectrum of identity. I think that what I recognized about what Hank and Chris and Vaieté kept saying is that within just even within the box of black and male, that spectral dynamic and complex identity oversimplified and reductive. And so one of the things that, as somebody who has, you know, just on the race side, a spectrum of identity, we were just really challenging. This is like before the conversation on intersectionality really took root, and the discourse around race and gender and sexuality. But now, you know, I look at my 13-year-old daughter, and it is a very different context for her. You know, the idea of identities as a spectrum and identities that are dynamic and that can actually change over time, and the idea that, you know, even something as what you would think hard baked as gender or race, particularly look at, you know, kind of gender identities, that they're accepting, they're much more accepting the idea of a complex and dynamic relationship to race. And the curriculum that we design, you know, really, you know, kind of encouraged critical thinking for individual students to think about their identities in a multifaceted way. Like, we kept, you know, kind of pushing and pushing for them to find other ways that they identify themselves. One, so that there's agency in defining yourself in your own terms, but also so that there is, you know, kind of breaks out of the simplicity of kind of the 20th century ideas of you're either this or that. Mm-hmm. And just one last little anecdote. When I was working at the Woodruff Art Center doing a massive kind of diversity program analysis, I had an interview with one of the executives there that was Asian. And when I walked in the room to do this qualitative interview, he said, "Look, if you're here to get the Asian perspective, you should just walk right out." He's like, "Because I don't have any context for that. But if you want the gay perspective, talk about that all day." And so it was like one of the, and that was a story that when we were talking about this project, we were like, this is a man who, from my perspective, looks Asian, but from his experience, he doesn't have the relationship to culture that, you know, Asian identities have, but he has a deep, you know, kind of cultural relationship more with his sexuality and gender. So it was interesting, you know, so I just throw that out there that I think we're moving into an age where people can accept the multi, you know, kind of spectrum nature of identity.
And if they can't, then let me just say, you know, that one of the things that we did in setting this up was simply allow the men to self-identify as black, however they looked visually. But all of the graphics and promotion that we do emphasize the wide range of genetic diversity that all come nominally under the heading of black males. And so seeing this range of different views come from men who look on the surface so different, mm-hmm. is a way that we're trying to deconstruct a lot of the assumptions people have about what a black man must be in our culture.
Well, we're going to come down the home stretch here shortly, so I'm going to kind of ask an open-ended question about how transformative this was for you, because this is one of those projects that affects everybody. The people who ask the questions in the project, the people who provided answers to the questions in the project, people who experience it, and I imagine that as the creator, it had to have changed you in some way. So, Chris, if you would, just tell me how this changed you.
Sure. Well, one of the things I emphasize to my students is that if you are doing a real creative project, the agency works both ways, as you say. Mm-hmm. You know, that you feel as if in some ways you're creating something that you're setting in motion, but it has an influence on your life. And I could never have anticipated the way that this project has reshaped my life. For one thing, I went from Bed-Stuy, when Bed-Stuy was a purely black community, to the Haight-Ashbury in 1967, which was, you know, primarily a white community. Question Bridge brought me deeply back into an engagement with the black community. Other than my family, that hadn't been true before. And for what it's worth, you know, my career as an artist and educator has been sort of transformed by the continuing popularity of this project.
Kamal Sinclair, you already said that you've started to think differently about black men because you make eye contact and you smile and you speak, and it's kind of changed the way you kind of move around in the world. As we wrap up, can you just kind of identify another way perhaps that this project changed how you live and how you walk through the world and deal with black men?
I do want to say that my father, my brothers, my sons, you know, some of the people that have been most dear, influential, and closest to me in my life are black men. So that's something also to think about in terms of the complexity of this. It's not that I'm with somebody that had no familiarity with black men. That's been my entire life, is the deepest, most intimate relationships have been with black men. But even in spite of that, we are primed with this kind of fear-based narrative that, you know, we know scientifically influences the, you know, consciousness of Americans in this country. And I think that has, you know, being able to investigate that through this project has influenced all of the work that I've done, particularly around, it might seem like a stretch, but I've been working in, you know, at the intersection of tech and storytelling for the last 8 years. And I've been really working closely with Sundance and the Ford Foundation and other institutions around diversifying, those that are making technology, especially media and technology, which we know the power of media.
Okay, Kamal St. Clair, I'm going to wrap you up because we've only got a few more seconds. Thank you so much for your input, and Chris Johnson, both of the Question Bridge Black Males Project. Thank you so much for your insights and for producing this. Your Call is produced at KALW in San Francisco. Laura Winnes is the producer. Kevin Vance is studio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Renee Kemp. It's Your Call.